Hello, welcome back to the show. We're going to do a Q&A episode. So thank you, as always, to everybody who asked a question. Really, really do appreciate it. You know, I put on my stories yesterday a question box of people that you'd like to see come on the podcast. You know, and in a funny way, I don't mean it in any other way than I chuckled. A lot of the names that people suggested are people that have already been on the podcast. So if you are, you know, if you were like, oh, I have Jordan Syed on the podcast, or you're like, oh, I have, you know, Chase Smith on the podcast, or have Chad Hargrove on the podcast. These are people who have all been on the podcast. And that I chuckled. I'm not like, oh, you should know that. Like, you should have listened to every episode. That's not what I'm saying. I just was like, these are great, great suggestions, and that's why they've been on the podcast before. But I really do appreciate that. I'd like to do a bit more interviews. If you have a person that you think is either a subject matter expert in a unique way about a topic that you really want, right? Like we had Dr. Lauren C.S. come on and talk about women's health. You know, again, guests either fall into like one of two camps where they have a really unique like knowledge base on a specific topic, or they are just generally somebody with an interesting perspective on something, more along the lines of like a coach who maybe, you know, has an engaging way of communicating. And it doesn't need to be like a very specific, somebody who does specific research on a specific topic. It can be that. And I think that having guests like that is incredible and we should absolutely do that. But it's also, hey, I just like listening to this person talk about stuff because they are profound or they are articulate or they speak in a way that resonates with me. That's cool too. So if you're listening to this and you feel like you have a suggestion for either a topic, some people were like, hey, get a bone health expert. And I think we've covered bone health a couple of times, but maybe not in such a direct manner that I think we could do. So I think that's a good one. But, you know, if you have a topic that you'd like to see a direct focus on or a person that you find interesting or articulate or profound or just educational, I'd love that and I'd appreciate that. So reach out to me and we'll see if we can get those people on this year. All right. Excellent. Without further ado, let's get into the questions. And again, I don't look at these questions beforehand. This is just like my NGL link, that anonymous link where I do Q&As on my social on my stories. I'll just go back in there and, you know, there's many questions still unanswered. So let's do those. So first question, trying to keep a check on my saturated fats. There's quite a bit of saturated fat in the 2x90% dark chocolate squares I eat every night. Is all saturated fat bad? This is such a astute question, because you're dead on the money. Dark chocolate is high, like the darker the chocolate gets, right, the higher the percentage, the more antioxidants, the more fiber, but also the more fat and the more saturated fat. It tends to be as the percents go down, the fat content, the fiber content, the antioxidant content goes down, and the sugar content goes up, let's say, very generally speaking. And you're right, dark chocolate is consistently spoken of as if it's a health food, but it's high in saturated fat. And from what we know, we want to keep our saturated fat relatively low, between, you know, or under roughly 10% of calories. And it's something that I talk about and people talk about. And it's like, okay, but what gives? Like, why is dark chocolate kind of getting a pass? And I'll tell you, dark chocolate gets a pass. Dark chocolate, if you were like, hey, I'm trying to reduce my saturated fat intake, I almost certainly would be not talking about your dark chocolate. And your question is a good one. Is all saturated fat bad? I'd say, first of all, I'd caution the idea that saturated fat is just bad inherently in all contexts, in all amounts. That's not how I would think of it, but too much saturated fat is not good. You know, so if you are keeping your saturated fat in check, then I think saturated fat has benefit. It's just that if we have too much saturated fat, we tend to see LDL increase and risk of cardiovascular disease go up and all of that good stuff, or not good stuff. But why does dark chocolate get a pass? Dark chocolate gets a pass because a large, you know, there are, I don't want to get too deep in the weeds, but you know, when we talk about fats, we usually break it into three categories, right? Unsaturated fat, polyunsaturated fat, and saturated fat. And without getting, you know, a little bit too deep into the weeds, there are different types of saturated fat. You know, there's unsaturated fat comes in monounsaturated fat and polyunsaturated fat. And there are different types of polyunsaturated fats, ones that are higher in omega-3s, ones that are higher in omega-6s, whatever. Same thing with saturated fat. There are different types of saturated fats. Let's just say the type of saturated fat that is primarily found in dark chocolate is called stearic acid, and it behaves differently than saturated fat from, let's say, butter. It tends to be what we'd say more metabolically neutral. It has more of a neutral impact, and the fiber in dark chocolate is great, and you get, you know, antioxidants, to be specific, things like polyphenols and flavanols. Dark chocolate is a underrated health food. I know it sounds crazy, but it's very high in antioxidants. It's high in fiber, and it has a fat that, let's call it, is, let's say, neutral from an LDL perspective. I think dark chocolate is something people should eat more. Not like in an indulgent way where you're, again, too much of anything can, you can start to skew the balance of your diet in a direction you might not want to. I think dark chocolate has, you know, I'm not, by the way, I'm not saying you shouldn't eat this at night. What I would say is dark chocolate has caffeine. And if you're someone who's particularly sensitive to caffeine, having, I don't think 2 squares of 90% dark chocolate is fucking up your sleep, right? But I would at least say, hey, like, if you're someone who's been struggling with your sleep and you also have dark chocolate at night, I would say, well, maybe let's try not doing that and let's see how that goes. You know, I don't offhand have the caffeine content of 90% dark chocolate. I'm gonna Google it as we're speaking here. How much caffeine in, let's say, 1 ounce 90% dark chocolate? And what we've seen, so it's about 20 to 30 milligrams of caffeine. So it's really not a lot. So I guess I kind of take it back, because what we do see is less than 100 milligrams of caffeine. Again, I don't like generalizing like this. We do have some research that looks at certain caffeine intake and how it impacts sleep. And we do see that less than 100 milligrams of caffeine tends to not really mess with sleep that much. But I still think if you're sensitive to caffeine and you have, you know, 30 to 50 milligrams of caffeine, that's like maybe like a diet soda or something, and you're struggling with sleep, then I at least, it would at least be something that would come up on the list of things to look at. But I don't think 2 squares of dark chocolate might even be less than an ounce, right? An ounce, 28 grams. So you might 2 squares, depending on what brand you're talking about in terms of squares, they come in different sizes. You're probably fine. But yeah, I wouldn't worry about it, frankly. I wouldn't. It's tough, because I do think trying to keep your saturated fat below 10% calories is a good piece of advice, but it does, this is kind of like, it's like telling people to get a certain amount of fiber because you hope that telling people to get a certain amount of fiber means that they'll eat more fruits and vegetables. And I think keeping your saturated fat below 10% is more likely a target so that you don't eat too much, you know, super high fatty meats, butter, tallow, you know, all of that stuff. So I'm not worried about this. Can you count it in your overall saturated fat intake? Yeah, you can count it, but it is more of a neutral impact in terms of cholesterol, and probably I'd stand by the fact that it's a net positive in terms of the fiber and antioxidant intake. Great question. Next question. Been using my Peloton for 2 years. I do a mix of Zone 2 and HIIT, but I'm thinking of switching to an Echo bike, mostly because I don't want to pay for the monthly fee for Peloton. Pros and cons of an Echo bike versus a Peloton for Zone 2 and HIIT. So I have an Echo bike. First of all, the thing is built like a freaking tank. This thing is going to, I'll pass this down to my grandkids. This thing is built like a tank. I don't think the pros and cons are, like, I'll try and list some pros and cons, but I think when we are talking about modalities for cardio, pick one that you like, right? Like, I'll give you some of the pros and cons in a second, but like, the pros and cons fall apart if you tell me you like one more than the other. Like, end of story. Period. End of story. If you're like, oh, I like the Peloton better, it's like, great, then you should, there's no pro of the Echo bike that is worth you doing it if you like the other one more. You know, pick a cardio modality or a couple that you don't hate, that you don't hate enough that you'll actually do them, right? So I think the Echo bike's upside is probably that it's a little bit more of a full body exercise. So if you just bike, it's just your lower body, essentially. And if you do the Echo bike, for those of you guys who are unfamiliar, the Echo bike is the one with the arms where you're also pushing the arms. So it's almost like has like elliptical handles to it, right? Like the Airdyne, if you ever watch CrossFit and you're watching them do the air bike, that's what it is. So it's a little bit more of a full body exercise because you also have to work your arms, and the Peloton, of course, being just a bike. But ultimately, that distinction doesn't really make a difference. If you bike enough, then your legs will adapt and get stronger. And all of a sudden, the bike is an amazing piece of cardio equipment. And frankly, that caveat I made doesn't really matter. It's an amazing piece of cardio equipment, period. Echo bike is amazing as well. You know, I think there are pros and cons. Sometimes I wish I had a regular bike where, you know, in case I have to, I don't know. The Echo bike is just, sometimes it's just fucking hard, I guess, you know? And what I would say also about the Echo bike is my one gripe with the Echo bike is that, so you can modify the seat. You can move the seat up and down and you can move it forward and back. But I have the seat almost all the way forward, so it's as close to the handles as possible. And if you can imagine, as you're moving the handles back and forth, during part of that kind of like upper body gait cycle, your hand moves away from you, right? If you're imagining you're pedaling with your hands, at some point that hand moves away from you. And even with the bike, the seat moved all the way forward. I'm 5'11 and 3/4. Hey, I find that handle, like I my wife gets on here and she's 5'3 and finds that those handles can be far away from her. And that's a slight discomfort, I'd say. So I do wish that there was more options to move the seat a little bit closer. So if you're really, really short, you might find that you're really leaning forward to get to that full range of motion on the upper body piece. But otherwise, they're both amazing. Again, like everything that just came out of my mouth goes right in the garbage. If you're like, oh, I like biking more than the Echo bike. Great, done deal. People think that the Air bike is just for high intensity work. You know, they just have this image in their heads of like going absolutely ham on the Air bike. That's you don't have to use it that way. I've done many hours of Zone 2 on the Echo bike and it works fantastic. It works great. Next question. I trained someone who has a lot of shoulder old injury limitations. So failure always comes not from the actual exercise or muscle, but from the joint/pain. I find it hard to work around. Yeah, you know, listen, as a personal trainer, there is a point where our jurisdiction ends and this becomes a physical therapy orthopedic issue. And it's certainly your job to first work around something rather than, you know, take it upon yourself to mend this person's injury in some way. And so I think without knowing more about your situation, your qualifications, this person, what their goals are, I think working around it is important. So I have a client right now who has some shoulder issues. And our first step is, okay, let's make a list of all the exercises that you can do pain-free. And let's make sure we're doing those and we are working hard, right? And then we'll make a list of all the stuff that hurts and we'll decide how much of that we want to implement. And of course, we will do so in a way where it's rehabilitative. We're not treating those exercises. Let's say your shoulder hurts and dumbbell pressing bothers your shoulder, but tricep pushdowns don't. I'm not going to ask you to go at your dumbbell press the same way you're going to go at your tricep extension. So we might make a list of things you can do without pain, and we're going to train those hard. And then we're going to take the things that you have, maybe you're like, well, I have a little bit of pain on these, but it's not so bad. Okay, maybe we implement that a little bit, but we stay a little further from failure. So we have two lists, stuff that hurts, we might implement it, but we are going to not implement it in the same way with the same volume and the same intensity as the stuff that doesn't hurt. And we might start to test the waters. Oh, you normally do 4 sets of chest. Okay, maybe we do 1 or 2 sets and we stay a little further from failure. And we see how your shoulder, does it get better? Does it stay the same? I'd want to be doing the things the person can do without pain and training those things hard, and then separating another list of stuff that does bother them and seeing how much of that can we implement and with what level of intensity so that it actually feels good. But I wouldn't try, and you're saying, hey, failure always comes from the actual, doesn't always come from the muscle, it comes from pain. I wouldn't be looking at those exercises like the dumbbell press as a place to get a really big stimulus. I'd be using it as a place to explore doing that joint function and that movement to see if, hey, what if we just peel back some stress? Instead of 4 sets of chest all the way to failure, let's do 1 or 2 sets, you know, 3 to 5 reps in reserve. Over the course of several weeks, does your shoulder get better because we've reduced the stress? That's something I'd want to pay attention to. Next question. One side is weaker than the other. What should I do for upper body? First of all, I would say, you know, don't worry about it. That's my first point, is don't really worry about this. Like, don't be worried that this is bad. Don't be worried that you're going to develop some sort of imbalance or like it mostly doesn't matter at all. The only time that this matters is if you have such a disparity in strength that it's actually like messing with your workout in some way where you're like, well, I'm doing, you know, a single arm bicep curl and my right side can do 8 and my left side can do 2. It's like, okay, now you're kind of like, it's messing with my diagnostics. Right? Like there's such a disparity between one side and the other that it's not like one side can do 6.5 and the other one can do 8. Because if that's the case, okay, you do 6.5, maybe you spot yourself, you give yourself a little bit of assistance on that 7th rep and it's all good and you move on in one rep. Like, listen, you're not meant to be symmetrical. Our bodies are not meant to be symmetrical. Asymmetries are important to the way we move and locomotion and all that stuff. So you being like, well, my right leg is 1 rep stronger or 2 reps stronger, that's normal. So definitely just like take that pressure off and that stress off of the idea that this is somehow bad. It's not. You know, you first of all, you're like most people are have a dominant side where you're way more coordinated. So you might find that you're a little stronger on the side that you're just more coordinated. It's not even like a muscle thing. It's a neurological thing where you're more coordinated on one side. So for starters, I wouldn't worry about it. If it's the case that it's messing with your workout in some way, you've decided, hey, it's messing with my tracking because one arm is way stronger than the other. I can't even use the same weight, stuff like that. I might track them separately. Right? I might track them separately. Right side did this, left side did this. Right side did this, left side did this. And if you are interested in bringing up that weaker side, you can do a couple of things. One of the things you can do is you could just do an additional set on the weaker side. It's like, okay, we do two sets of tricep extensions on the right and we do three sets of tricep extensions on the left. And you hope that over the course of time, the left gets a little bit more stimulus. It gets a little bit stronger. It might not catch up though. Like it might not be the case that that just works itself out. So I would always fall back on this isn't a big deal. You're not meant to be symmetrical. Another thing you can do is implement intensity techniques on that weaker side. So you might, let's say you do, you know, I'll give you some practical examples. You can either, I'm going to use a bicep curl, single arm, preacher curl, whatever. You can either start with the stronger side. So let's say you do 8 on your right and your right is the stronger side. And then you can only do 5 on the left. What you can do is you can do what's called myorep match, which is, okay, you get that 5th rep and you can't do any more. But instead of being done, you rest for 10 seconds and then you do a 6th rep and you rest for 10 seconds and you do a 7th rep and you rest for 5 seconds, whatever. It doesn't need to be 10 seconds, 5 seconds. And then you do that 8th rep. And so you used myoreps, which are just super short rest periods. It's like just rest pause. If you've heard of rest pause, that's what it is. And you get yourself to match the stronger side. And that's how you get the weaker side more stimulus. You could also start with the weaker side and match with the stronger side. So you start with that weaker side and you do 5. And you just do 5 on the right. Now, if you finish doing 5 on the right and you're like, I'm not even remotely close to failure, I wouldn't do that. But if they're like one rep apart, if you're like, my right can do 8 and my left can do 7. It's like, okay, maybe you start with the left and you do 7 and the right does 7 and it's all good because they're both close enough to failure. So those are some options, but I really can't stress this enough. You're not meant to be symmetrical. The minute you start doing unilateral training, you will find that one side's a little bit better than the other, and that's okay. Next question. My gym's hyperextension machine can adjust more horizontal than 45, so it can go down to 35. Are there any benefits? Feels harder. But what is this doing for muscle bias versus keeping it at 45? So this is a great question. I'm going to try and visualize this for you. So the 45 degree hip extension is just a 45 degree RDL, right? So it is a hip hinge. You are bending at the hip, right? I want you to imagine that an RDL, when you are standing up, we're going to call that a 90 degree hinge. So you're standing straight up. You're bending at the hips. And then you have a 45 degree hip extension, same motion, but on a 45 degree angle. And then you have like a GHD. If you've ever seen people doing like a GHD back extension, it's the same thing, except your body is horizontal, parallel with the floor. So we have one hinge where you're straight up, one hinge where you're on a 45 degree angle, and another hinge where you are completely flat, like parallel with the floor. This is going to change where the exercise is hardest. And it's going to change a little bit in terms of muscle bias. And so we have to also say that in all three examples, your knees are locked out because that is a feature of the 45 degree hip extension, unless you do a slight knee bend, which you could do. And so essentially, what you'd be doing is the lower you bring that angle, the more glutes and the less hamstrings. Now, it's more complicated than this. You know, it's not just like, oh, Jordan said that the lower I bring that angle. So a GHD on paper is more glutes than a 45 degree hip extension. The problem is that's not enough to make the GHD a better glute exercise. I personally find the GHD not comfortable, not intuitive, doesn't feel good. I get way more lower back. And so it isn't as simple as saying, hey, as I bring that angle down, I'm going to get more glutes. It's not that simple. Now, I think going from 45 to 35 isn't such a huge change in the movement. And of course, you're on the same machine, so it's the same kind of constraints. I think you could go to 35 if you were like, well, I really want to make this more glutes. You'd probably get a little bit more glutes. I want to be careful. Anytime I mention glutes, I think people are so obsessed with training glutes that they're like, oh, Jordan said the GHD is better for glutes. So it's not that RDLs are amazing for glutes. Now, if you do them with stiff leg, it's definitely way more hamstrings and way less glutes. I still find that the 45 degree angle, if you have three choices, a stiff leg RDL, a 45 degree hip extension, or a GHD, which is like a 0 degree hip extension, let's say, let's say your goal is glutes, I still find the 45 degree hip extension to be the best balance of where the glutes work hard, resistance profile, and comfort, and ease of execution. And so, yeah, going down to 35 on paper makes it a few percentage points more glutes and a few percentage points less hamstrings. But you can hear it in my voice. I don't get animated about this. Because you have the option and because it's the same machine and it's still equally stable, I think you could go to 35 if your goal was, hey, I want to make this as glutes as possible. You could. I just think you should pick the one you feel you, or a couple of them that you execute really well, and you should get really freaking strong at them. And these sorts of like tiny little nuances aren't a big deal. But I'm not saying you think, dear question asker, I'm not saying you're saying that it's mega important. I'm just getting ahead of the idea that the answer I just gave is going to have people running to the GHD, running away from their 45 degree hip extension. And I want to repeat, when I say RDL, what I should have said was stiff leg RDL. So no knee bend. Because when you start bending your knees in the RDL, it becomes a better and better glute exercise. So this was a context of a stiff leg RDL, a 45 degree hip extension, also using locked knees, stiff legs, and a GHD, again, with, you know, straight legs, full knee extension. So, yeah, I don't get worked up. I could modify my machine as well. I just don't. I feel like 45 is where I'm super duper comfortable and super duper strong. And frankly, the difference in glute to ham ratio of work between 45 degrees and 35 degrees is just minute. So I just don't want anyone to get caught up in the weeds, but this isn't you getting caught up in the weeds. This is you asking a very valid question here. So hope that helps. Next question. I'm considering doing an RMR test. So basically a resting metabolic rate. So getting a marker of your resting metabolism. I'm tired of playing a guessing game with how much I should eat, being as a petite perimenopausal woman. Is this something you think can be helpful to just get some real data to set some weight loss goals? You know, this person says, I could stand to lose 15 pounds, pros or cons. I think this is a waste of time and money. Personally, I'm not saying you'd learn nothing, but here's the deal. Like, whoever you are, question asker, I'm just here to be as helpful as possible. So if I'm a little direct here and there, it's to save you some time. I'm not attacking any of the question. I love the question. It's a good question. I see the logic. The logic is if I just really knew what my resting energy expenditure was and I used a fairly accurate activity multiplier, I could really find out how many calories I need to eat. The problem is all that matters is if you use that data and you eat less than it and you don't lose weight, you're going to be pissed off. And that can happen because the test isn't perfect. Your activity multiplier is not perfect. It doesn't factor in how our bodies adapt to eating less calories. It doesn't also take into account the fact that there's a ton of human error. And I don't mean that like you stink at tracking. I mean it that even the most astute trackers are going to be technically off because nutrition labels can be off. Meals out are estimated. Not every nutrition label is even ones with like barcodes. It's not always perfect. So there is an element of variability no matter how hard you try. And so if you're the more you try to be mega hyper accurate, the more pissed off you're going to be if it doesn't work. My advice to you, listen, you can do this. And if you do this and you use it as a starting point and then you trust the data thereafter, it's going to be fine. What do I mean by trusting the data? I mean, if you do this and your RMR comes out to be 1300, right? And then you've decided with a certain calorie calculator that you have a 1.5 activity multiplier. That's going to put your maintenance calories at 1950. If you get that information and you're like, I've been eating 1500 calories and not losing weight, you're going to be pissed off and you're going to think something's wrong with you. There isn't anything wrong with you. You just have to eat less. Somewhere along the lines, between your tracking being off, and I'm not attacking you, but there are inherent variations or inherent inaccuracies in tracking, whether you are astute and detailed with your tracking or not, some sort of error in the RMR test itself, some sort of error in your activity multiplier decision, and then some sort of error in not, of course you can't calculate, but I'm saying the lack of a accounting for how your body will respond to the calorie deficit. My point is, even if you have the seemingly perfect scientific lab-tested data, it might not work. And you, when I say it might not work, I mean you might eat less than it says your RMR is, or it says your total energy expenditure is, and you might vehemently expect to lose weight because this is what science says, and it might not work. And if it doesn't work, it's not that something's broken about you. It's that somewhere along the lines, that calorie number is wrong. And you need to eat less if you want to lose weight. And by the way, I'm not suggesting you do that, by the way, and you could also move more. But like, I see this as, I want to know for sure exactly how many calories I'm supposed to eat to lose weight. And I'm hesitant that it's possible to absolutely know that outside of just starting and seeing what the data tells you, right? Like, your pursuit of the exact number that's right for you, I'm nervous, because the more you think that's the right number, the more you think something's going to be wrong with you if it doesn't work. And that's not a mindset I'd want you to be in, because if it doesn't work, then there's nothing wrong with you. You just aren't in a deficit, and you can decide if you want to eat less or move more to create a deficit, but those will be your options. And I fear the, well, science said this, and so something must be wrong with me, because I would say that that's not true. Next question. I can't decide which kind of treadmill to buy. I'm deciding between a regular one that can incline, nothing fancy, or one of those self-propelled curved one. Any thoughts? I think if you, it's not even the case that like if you're an advanced runner, you should get a self-propelled curved one because that's better for running. I don't even think that that's exactly how that works. I don't think there's that big of a difference. I actually don't really like this, and even if you have a self-propelled curved one, you can still get one that is also not self-propelled, right? That also has the option of the belt just moving on its own, set at a certain pace. I will say I'm not an expert on the upside of that propelled or the self-propelled curved one. But what I can tell you is that elite athletes use regular treadmills and they increase performance like crazy. And if it were me, I would kind of want the ability to make it go on an incline. And I don't know if I could be convinced by any of the marginal benefits in certain places to having it be curved. Besides, it being curved kind of does mean you're always a little bit running on an incline, right? It's like you tend to be always running on that slight part of the incline on the treadmill. So I'm not someone who sees the self-propelled curved treadmills and thinks, oh, there's some super unique advantage, I need to get one of those, especially as someone who does kind of take his running a little bit seriously. So I wouldn't ruminate too much on this. You know, this is now on my mind, and if I think of another deciding factor, I'll post this question to social media, but I can't think of a, like, I would try both and see which one are you going to do more? Like, if having the incline means that you can run on a flat, you can run on the incline, you can walk on the incline, and having more options is going to make you more likely to be consistent. And if you get a propelled curved one, you just have like one option of like running or walking on it as it is, then I would at least consider that as a factor. Next question. In a calorie deficit, what's the lowest you'd recommend for daily fat intake? I think it's really easy to say something like 0.3 grams per pound for, you know, making sure you have enough dietary fat to optimize hormone intake. I would say that, though, like, short periods of time where you don't eat that much fat, or you eat, let's say, less than that number while you're losing weight, it depends who you are, by the way. The heavier you are, I think the less this will matter. The leaner you are, I think the more this will matter. But I'm not, again, great question. You deserve an answer to this question, but I tend to think every time you start the question with, in a calorie deficit, what I hear is for a very short period of time in my life, right? Like, you should not be in a calorie deficit for the majority of your life or trying to be in a calorie deficit, right? It should be this thing you're doing for a short period of time. Again, I say relative to the length of your life, not like days, but it could be a month, could be 6 months, right? But, you know, I just, when someone's like, oh, in a calorie deficit, in a calorie deficit, how much fiber should I get? It's like, that's still an important question. But if you told me that you underate fiber, but you were successful in your cut and you lost the weight you wanted to lose, and you transition to maintenance. And in maintenance, you ate more fiber and you ate a more balanced diet. Like, you're going to be at maintenance for 99% of your life or more. So like, that's where I'd focus more on having this, like, on these sorts of nuances of my actual dietary intake. Again, I'm not saying this doesn't matter, but like, if I said, oh, you got to eat 0.3 grams per pound. So 0.3 grams per pound for a 150 pound person is 45 grams of fat. And you say, oh, Jordan, I've only been eating 35 grams of fat. I'd be like, okay, are you, how do you feel? Are you losing weight? Do you feel okay? Like, and if you're like, yeah, I'm losing weight, I feel okay, I'd be like, you don't need to panic about this. You know, like, we're only in this deficit maybe for like another 6 weeks or something. I don't, you know, I'm making up a hypothetical here, but I don't want to get too worked up over like what you do for this very short period of time in your calorie deficit. My answer still stands that 0.3 grams per pound is a decent general ballpark lower limit for fat intake per day. Again, that's a 150 pound person, 45 grams of fat. But I'm just not so fussed. You know, protein is the one where I might be a little bit more fussed just so we don't lose muscle in a cut, but I'm also the opposite of the muscle loss police. I think it's actually not a big deal. I think people dramatically over exaggerate the fears around muscle loss in a cut if you're lifting weights. But yeah, maybe a conversation for another time. Next question. What is your thought on GLP-1s to lose the stubborn 10? Not budging. Age 66 female. Lift 2 to 3 times per day. I think you mean per week. Walk daily. Focus on protein and fiber. So essentially, you're like, hey, I'm doing everything right. I'd like to lose the last 10 pounds. And she said, if that is an option, what is a good source? I'll give it to you straight. If the last 10 pounds, if we're assuming, you didn't mention what your current body composition is like. So if you're saying the last 10 to go from, I'm going to use BMI here, but I'm only going to use that to just make a point. I don't think BMI is a nearly even close to perfect marker here. But let's say you're like, well, I want to lose the last 10 to go from a 26 BMI to a 24 BMI or a 30 BMI to a 28 BMI. I think that we're talking about weight loss that might matter for health. But if you're saying, I want to lose the last 10 to go from already healthy and lean to much leaner and kind of see my abs or get a deltoid striation or something, then we're just talking about something different, right? So like 10 pounds means something different for someone who's already a healthy body weight, right? So that would be reflect a larger percent of your current body weight that would go from lean to very lean. So if you're saying, I'm already lean and healthy, my blood work is good, and I want to lose the last 10 pounds, and I'm not coming at you when I say this, but for purely aesthetic reasons, first of all, before I answer you, I promise I will answer. You, question asker, and you, listener, are welcome to do with your body what you want. I am not, if you listen to my answer and you're like, I don't care, I'm going to do what I want. I support you doing what you want. 100%, I support you doing. I support people who, I guess I support you doing anything you want with your body, provided you're making an informed decision, right? That you actually have all the information and you're making a thought out decision for what's best for you and your body. I support you. Do I think taking a GLP-1 to go from lean to very lean, healthy to shredded, do I, as of now, think that's a net positive for health? The answer is, I'm not sure. What I do know is losing those 10 pounds to go from like lean to very lean or like healthy to lean, like, probably doesn't make you healthier. What I don't know, and what nobody knows what I'm about to say. No one. I don't care who is saying it. They do not know. We do not know if these drugs have an independent health benefit to people who are already at a normal body weight. Some people are going to be like, no, we've seen that it has an independent benefit for cardiovascular health. Yes, it does, in people who have obesity. Not in people who are healthy, walking around healthy body weight, healthy, you know, low risk of cardiovascular disease. We don't know that. So what we also know is that you probably have to take this drug forever if you want the benefits forever. Now, there's a percentage of people who are able to get off the drugs or go on a lower dose and maintain largely, you know, a good chunk of the benefit. But you shouldn't expect to be that person. you should expect to not be that person, right? It's like if 10% of people don't have to take the medication forever, you should expect not to be one of those 10% people, right? 90% of people. So you should expect to take this drug forever if you want the benefits forever. If you aren't, if you don't have to, that's great. I'm just saying that is a, it's like if I'm holding 10 cards and 5 of them are black cards and 1 of them is a red card, you should expect if I hold them face down, you should expect that you're going to grab a black card. Like it's just irrational to expect you're going to grab a red card. So I support you doing this if you know. Like if you said to me, Jordan, I know that we don't have data on people like me doing what I'm doing. Because we don't. We do not have data on healthy people losing the last 10 pounds and taking this drug for 30 to 50 years. We don't have that data. So if you're saying we don't have that data, but I'm what I've seen so far is that in the populations we have studied, it seems relatively safe for the time we've studied them, which is not that long, you know, sub 5 years. And I'm willing to take that chance because the potential benefits of being leaner and maybe these independent health benefits that we don't know exist yet, I'm willing to take that chance. Then I support you. Then you go do it. If you can afford it and you want to go do it. I know people in my life doing that. And as long as they're not blind to A, that they have to take this for life if they want the benefits, almost certainly, and B, that we don't have data on you. We don't have data on you. Then I support you. And I wouldn't even say that person's, like, it's not like I'd be like, oh, like, I support you, but I think you're dumb. Like, I don't think that. I think you're, whatever, I don't even like saying I think you're dumb. Like, I think, I don't understand the idea of making this decision without all that information. Like, that to me is not a, I wouldn't treat my body that way where I, like, let's say one day I wanted to go on TRT or something. I would learn a lot about what we know about people like me who take TRT, right? So we don't know anything about people who are lean, who take these drugs for life. We don't know that. So that's what I'll say is you'd be taking a chance. Again, when people say the stubborn 10, my assumption is that this is a healthy person who wants to get lean. And I'm not sure. I don't know if that's a net positive. That is a net a greater benefit to risk ratio. I don't know. We don't know. So I'm not sure is my answer. I'm not sure that this is a net positive for health. I don't know that. And I would assume you need to take this drug forever. And I will share candidly that not you, I'm not saying you should feel this way. I promise. I'm not saying that. I would be a little bit nervous about feeling what it feels like and then going back to not having that feeling. So I'll give you an example. The reason I've never taken steroids is because I would be so nervous about how amazing I would feel and how amazing I would look if I took steroids. And I'd be so nervous about not taking steroids and losing those benefits. So it's like, it's almost like, you know, I'll give you a stupid example, promise. It's like an addiction. I would be nervous about the withdrawal. And those words are heavy. I don't mean that in a clinical way. I just mean, let's say I would take a GLP-1 and let's say I got even leaner and I'm like, damn, that's cool. And I'm like never thinking about food. And it's, what if I loved it? What if I loved it? I'd be nervous because I would say, I'm not sure this is good for me. And I'm nervous about not feeling those benefits anymore. I don't want to go back to not feeling those benefits, but I'm also not sure what's going to happen to me if I stay on this medication. So that's how I currently feel. But I'm super open. I'm very pro GLP-1s I'm very pro GLP-1s where we know it to be a low risk, high reward application. Very pro GLP-1s. I think they're a miracle of modern medicine, frankly. I think we are only at the tip of the iceberg, and they are amazing drugs for people who are going to lose a ton of weight and improve their insulin sensitivity like crazy and get way healthier. For those people, totally. The last thing I'll say is I'm also nervous. You're a 66-year-old female. I know you lift 2 to 3 times a week. I'm stoked about that. I know you eat enough protein. I'm stoked about that. If your appetite was cut in half, let's say, and I'm not saying that's what would happen. Let's say you have a really big appetite suppression. I'd be a little nervous about you not getting in enough protein, and I'd be nervous about how that would impact muscle and bone adaptations. I don't think protein's the end of the world, but the struggle is, like, if you have much less appetite, I'm telling you, protein is the hardest macronutrient to get. And I would hate to see anyone, but particularly women, and not just any women, but particularly postmenopausal women, do anything that would risk frailty, you know? And so I would be a little bit like, hey, if you do that, like, and your protein gets slashed in half and you're more tired for your lifts and those things fall off a little bit, I'd be nervous. And by the way, I'm not saying that's what would happen. I'm not even saying that's what I would bet would happen. That would be a thing that would be on my mind. All right, guys, we're going to call it there. Great questions. Thanks for letting me kind of go a little bit more in depth into a couple of those. And I will see you guys on the next episode.
Thanks for tuning in to this episode of Where Optimal Meets Practical. If you liked the episode, it would mean the world to me if you posted a screenshot to your social media or left a 5-star review on iTunes. That stuff really helps. If you ever want to get in touch with me, just shoot me a DM on Instagram @JordanLipsFitness. I'm always around to chat. Thanks, guys. Have a good one.